Well, famously, the Buddha never did a day's work in his life, and I think that that can be a little bit of a challenge to us with our work ethic, with the way that we define ourselves and define our status in terms of work. What the Buddha was doing, I mean, it wasn't that he was inactive, was it? I mean, during his life, I think of him as being like one of those huge great temple bells, and he's just constantly sounding this bell. So wherever you go, you can hear the reverberations of this beautiful sound of the bell. And in his lifetime, he had thousands and thousands of encounters. That's what I think of when I think of the Buddha. I think of all these recorded, it's fantastic we've got them recorded, all these recorded encounters with all sorts of people in which he would respond in very, very different ways to different people. He was somebody that you would meet. And when you met the Buddha, then something happened and the truth emerged, or the truth entered you. So I want to start off with an example of this. Now, on this occasion, he was staying outside Rajgriha. Now, Rajgriha was a big city with huge walls, big gates, a real sort of classic Troy-type city. But he was following his custom, which is to stay with his full-time disciples outside the city in a park. This park was called the Squirrels' Feeding Ground. So you can imagine this place where everyone came to give peanuts to the squirrels. And early in the morning, what would he do? He'd go in just by himself, just walk in through the gates of the city to see if he could get any food for breakfast, because he didn't work, so he couldn't buy it. So on this particular occasion, it's early, and he's coming just passing the river, which flowed past Rajgriha. And he's about to go into the city, but he spots this young guy behaving very eccentrically. What the guy was doing, he was soaking wet for a start. So he was dripping, there was water dripping off his hair. And he was standing on the river bank, rather sheepishly doing these strange sort of mime actions. And he was doing a sort of a kowtow. First of all, to the eastern direction. He was saying a little verse as he went along, you know, something like, may the protectors of the east, I don't know what it was, you know, see what I mean? And to each of the directions he'd say something. May the protectors of the east give me something to eat and that kind of thing. So he'd be going around doing this kowtowing to the east, to the south, to the west, to the north, and he even did it to the ground and to the sky. So he went through this ritual looking rather sheepish because he was aware that the Buddha was watching him. And when he'd finished, the Buddha asked him what he was doing. And they got into a very interesting conversation, and he told him his story. And his name was Sigalaka. Sigalaka means Mr. Jackal. So I think of him, I don't know, this may be very unfair, but I think of him as being a foxy sort of character, a bit of a rogue in a way, judging by what happens later. A young man, maybe about 18, fairly well off, but enjoys the nightlife, the life of the city, girlfriends, fancy chariot, all that kind of thing, having a great time. And he explains, well, he says, the reason I'm doing this is for my dad. It's for my dad I'm doing this. You see, he was quite worried about me, and he used to talk to my mum about it and say, I'm really worried about young Foxy, what he's getting up to, you know, because his father was a businessman, quite successful, fairly well off, running this business, and he was just quite concerned about his son. And his father fell ill, and he knew he wasn't going to last very long, and he knew that Foxy was going to be the one to take over the business. And he thought to himself, it's just not going to work, is it, this guy? It's not going to work. I've got to do something about it. And so what he said was, what you've got to do, in order to make sure the business goes all right, you've got to get the protection of the gods of the directions. You've got to go for the guardians. You've got to go for the protectors. So I want you to do, every morning, I want you to promise me, every single morning, without fail, you'll go down, do your ablutions in the river, wash yourself off completely, and then do the homage to the protectors of the six directions, and then the business will go all right. So this is what his father had said to him. And he said, I was very fond of my father indeed. You know, I was, you know, very, very upset at his illness. And especially when he did die after a while, you know, I was very upset. So I made a promise to him. I said, I will do this. Every morning I'll do this. So that is why I'm doing it, you know. And so the Buddha sort of didn't say anything for a while. But then he thought, well, he said, I can tell you how to do it better. I can tell you how to do that ritual better, so that you get a really strong protection from the directions, the protectors of the six directions. And he went on, and it's in the Digha Nikaya, the long sayings of the Buddha. And he went on to give quite an extensive teaching on how to live in an effective way, an ethical life, and a life in which your business is going to succeed as well. That's why I mentioned it today, because Sigalaka was a businessman. He'd taken over his father's business, even though he was so young. And the Buddha's advice was partly on how you can make sure that that works out, your work works. And the center of the Buddha's teaching is this business of a mandala, forming a mandala of relationships around you, of regarding the directions not as deities, but as the different relationships, the different kinds of relationships you have in your life. Your relationship with your parents, with your friends, with your teachers, and so on. And also the relationship between the employer and the employee in a business, in a working situation. And what the sutra shows is how ethics and relationships and the way they interact with each other are really crucial sides of living a Buddhist life, including in your work. And I think this is what comes out in the early Buddhist teachings on right livelihood. It's to do with ethics, it's to do with the relationships that you develop in your working situation. Now, in the Sigalavada Sutta, it's very much clearly conventional work relationships. He's the boss, he's got these employees. These are the mutual duties of the two to each other. And I will come back to that later on, just have a look at what the teaching was, but I'll mention that later. But what I also want to go into here, both from the tradition and from our own experience in the FWBO, is on work not just in conventional working relationships, but also work as sangha. How can your work be your sangha? How can your sangha come into your work? So what I'm going to go through is talking about right livelihood in ethical terms, and then how it fits into the Eightfold Path, which is where we hear about this term right livelihood, something about the different kinds of unethical work that are proscribed, are forbidden in early Buddhism. But then the other side of that coin, which is the possibilities for happiness in work. This is a teaching that maybe isn't so well known from the Buddha on enjoyment, fun, and happiness in your working life. And maybe one or two other of the Pali teachings on it as well. Then I'll look at other aspects of Buddhist teachings on work. Maybe in particular mindfulness through your work practice, some teachings on that. And also, what about gaining insight? What about gaining wisdom through work as well? And then we'll look at work as sangha, at team-based right livelihood in the Buddhist tradition as a whole, and particularly in the FWBO and in Sangharakshita's teachings. And some reflections on that whole business of team-based right livelihood. And then I'll finish by going back again to Foxy. And something very interesting that happens at the end of that, quite unexpected that happens at the end of that sutra. I'll tell you about that later. So the first thing that you notice when you read the Buddhist teachings on work is incredibly simple, that right livelihood equals ethical livelihood. It's as simple as that. Right livelihood equals ethical livelihood. It means ethical working. And he goes on and on and on about that. But we have it here in the Eightfold Path, as you probably know. And right livelihood is not really a very good translation. I was looking up this just only yesterday, actually, to check out the meaning. Right livelihood is sama ajiva in Pali. Now, sama is a very similar word to our word summit. Does anybody know the etymology of the word summit? is, again, I didn't realize this, it means a breast, a woman's breast. So I guess the peak of a mountain is compared to that. So Amma, in summer, Amma means nursing. And Sa means one or united. So it's a little bit obscure, isn't it? You know, how do you get from that to the Noble Eightfold Path? United nursing. Might be a good name for a right livelihood business, though, mightn't it? You know. If you were doing nursing, that is. But so what it comes is to, it comes to mean something which is consummate, something which is a peak, something which is high, in the same way as the summit is compared to the breast. And ajiva does mean, literally means livelihood. Jiva means your life. But it comes to mean not just your life in the terms of living, but in terms of how you make your living. It's very interesting. We have exactly the same idiom in English. And then, so that's right livelihood. So it would be better, really, to say something like peak livelihood or perfect livelihood or consummate livelihood. The other side of it, there's always, for the whole Noble Eightfold Path, there's the ignoble eightfold path, the one where it's miccha, as in you probably heard of, you know, miccha ditti, for example, wrong view. And miccha, again, doesn't really mean wrong. It means the opposite of samma. It means contrary, what is contrary or mistaken. So you do have teachings on what is wrong livelihood, so-called, but really means mistaken livelihood or contrary livelihood, livelihood that goes against the perfection and the peak of right livelihood. So when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but you've got these phases in it, haven't you? You've got the phase of vision at the beginning. You've got a phase of ethics, yeah? Then you've got a phase of meditation and mindfulness. And then what people often don't realize is that in the Buddha's teaching, the Noble Eightfold Path, he says, and the end of it, after perfect samadhi or perfect meditation, comes liberation and knowledge of liberation. So it often has this extra stage at the end, just to make it clear that the aim of the Eightfold Path is liberation. So right livelihood or perfect livelihood is in this phase of ethics, in the ethics phase. Do you remember you've got perfect speech, that is communication, you've got perfect action, the way you live your life, what you do, and then you've got perfect livelihood. It's right there, literally in the middle of the Noble Eightfold Path. And what does this imply? Well, it implies that obviously it's being stressed, you know, because this is one of the central teachings of the whole of Buddhism, and the Buddha sticks it right in the middle, right in the ethics phase of things, in the way of living phase of things. But it also implies something else, which is it's an aspect of a path. And a path, the path in Buddhism, the way that you tread, means that it's something you move along. It's something that you actually cultivate in yourself, isn't it? It's not just either you do it or you don't. It's something you're working on as part of the path. And I think we need to sort of remember that when we look at the future teachings I'll be going into on perfect livelihood, that it's something you work on. It's not something that is either okay or isn't okay. It's something that you always work on and you benefit from. You gain spiritual and mental benefits from it in various ways. So I'll just give you a quote. I'll give you quite a few quotes here. And I'm going to hand out a little pamphlet I have produced of all these quotes, so you don't need to try and write them down, and more as well. There's the stuff in there I won't have time to go into in the talk. And it also, as a bonus, it has a reading list on the back of currently available books on the generally on the subject of right livelihood. So this is the Buddha putting right livelihood in the context of the Eightfold Path. How is it that perfect vision is the forerunner? One discerns mistaken livelihood as mistaken livelihood and perfect livelihood as perfect livelihood. And what is mistaken livelihood? It's scheming, persuading, hinting, belittling, and pursuing gain with gain. This is mistaken livelihood. One tries to abandon mistaken livelihood and to enter into perfect livelihood. This is one's perfect effort. So he's relating it to other bits of the Eightfold Path. Remember, perfect effort is also an important phase of the Eightfold Path. One is mindful to abandon mistaken livelihood and enter and remain in perfect livelihood. This is one's perfect mindfulness. These three qualities, therefore, perfect vision, perfect effort, and perfect mindfulness, run and circle around perfect livelihood. So they're the supports for it. And it's worth, again, remembering this: effort, mindfulness, and vision. And I think all of these are going to be coming up later on. Effort or energy, if you like. So there are a number of teachings also in the Pali Canon which go into this business of what is mistaken livelihood. And they're clearly to do, as I say, with whether they're ethical or not. So you can just reflect on your livelihood in terms of the precepts. There's a particular list that comes up often, which is these five trades ought not to be plied by a lay disciple: trade in weapons, trade in human beings, trade in flesh, trade in intoxicants, and trade in poison. So they're all, in a way, they're quite extreme forms of imperfect or mistaken livelihood, aren't they? But I think they're worth, I'm not going to go into this in detail, one could give a whole talk probably on ethics in work, but I think it's worth reflecting on these, you know, that, okay, maybe I'm not trading in weapons, but am I producing things that do cause harm? This is what the first precept is. It's to do with, I undertake the principle of training not to harm living beings. So am I doing anything that causes harm? Trading in human beings, again, you know, am I using people, regarding them in some sense of objects for my own benefit rather than as individuals in their own rights? Maybe I'm not actually a slave trader or whatever, or a pimping prostitute, but maybe I'm doing something which is regarding people as objects. Trading in flesh. So, you know, it's clear this business of not trading in meat, and that one is promoting vegetarianism, promoting the kindness to animals. Trading in intoxicants, all sorts of intoxicants one could include there, no doubt, that might be involved in some way in your business. And trade in poison, you know, damaging the environment, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, but we could go into that quite a lot. But it's interesting, I think, that, you know, we'll probably find some livelihoods that we would regard as unethical that are not included in that list. And there are other lists elsewhere in the Pali Canon. Okay, I wanted to counter that, though, with another teaching the Buddha gives, which is not so much on, you know, it's naughty to do that, and you shouldn't do that, and avoid that, and oh dear, that's unethical. This business of happiness in work, which is a fairly extensive sutta that the Buddha taught. I'm not going to read out the whole thing, but I'll mention a bit of it. Yeah, well, the sources, they're all in the pamphlet I'll give out. This is called The Four Appropriate Happinesses, and it's from the Anguttara Nikaya. So the Four Appropriate Happinesses. I'll just read out the beginning. Herein, householder, these four kinds of happiness are appropriate for one who leads the household life and enjoys the pleasures of the senses. They are the happiness of ownership, the happiness of enjoyment, the happiness of freedom from debt, and the happiness of blamelessness. And I'll just mention the first one. What's the happiness of ownership? A son of good family possesses wealth that has been obtained by his own diligent labor, acquired through the strength of his own arms and the sweat of his own brow. Rightly acquired, rightly gained. That is, ethically acquired, ethically gained. He experiences pleasure. He experiences happiness, thinking, I possess this wealth that's been obtained by my own diligent labor, acquired through the strength of my own arms, the sweat of my own brow, rightly acquired and rightly gained. And this is the happiness of ownership. And what you can, when you look through this sutta, you realize that it's partly just saying, well, if you do manage to make some money, that's fine. There's nothing unethical about this. It's quite interesting in Buddhism. Buddhism doesn't, as Ambedkar says, Buddhism does not ennoble poverty. So it says if you manage to become prosperous, that is fine as long as it's done in an ethical way. But what you can do is extend this teaching a little bit, as Jack Kornfield does in quite an interesting lecture he gave on right livelihood. You can extend it into the attitude you have to the work itself. So you can summarize these as, first of all, the joy or the happiness in what you've already got. So you look at your work, your career, your job as it is, and you say, what elements are there in there which are just really nourishing, really fun, really enjoyable? It may not be perfect. There are probably lots of ways in which you complain about it, but you look at it and say, actually, this isn't bad, is it? So look for the rewarding, enjoyable aspects and the benefits that you get from them. Including, you're just appreciating the fact you get some money from it. You know, that's nice, isn't it? You know, I can spend that on things. And then the second one is joy in what you do with it. So it's joy in what you use your work for or what you create in your work. So the creativity side, I think, is very important as well, the productivity side. Feeling, yeah, I'm satisfied with what I'm making or what's coming out of my work, and I'm also satisfied and enjoying the creative process. And this you can't always get, actually, and this is one of the cases where you may say, okay, I'm going to change my job now, because there's nothing creative there in it at all. But to look at the creative side is very satisfying, if you can find that. And then the final two are joy in non-dependency, the independence that you can have through working. The Buddha originally just talks about freedom from debt, but if you think of those in more general terms, it's not being dependent on others for your welfare. And then finally, joy in a free heart, joy in a clear conscience, which the Buddha says is the most important happiness of all, a happiness of having the sense that you're leading the kind of life which is actually improving the world rather than making it a worse place. So I think it's quite encouraging, this teaching of the Buddha on the joy that you can gain, the happiness that you can gain through your work and through your livelihood. The last one is joy in a free heart. That's the way I'm putting it. But particularly joy in being ethical. Happiness in realizing that you're being ethical. And all of those, the whole sutta, or the whole part of the sutta is there in the handout. There are lots of other teachings in the Pali Canon, although, as I'll say later, they're very limited in a way, but there are lots of other teachings, and I'll just mention one of them. There are four conditions of Vyagapajya which conduce to a householder's weal and happiness in this very life. Which four? The accomplishment of persistent effort, the accomplishment of watchfulness, the accomplishment of good friendship, and balanced livelihood. And the Buddha goes in to explain this. By whatever activity a householder earns his living, whether by farming or by trading or rearing cattle, archery, service under the king, or any other kind of craft, at that he becomes skillful and is not lazy. He's endowed with the power of discernment as to the proper ways and means. He's able to carry out and allocate duties. And this is called the accomplishment of persistent effort. And once again, there are four of these accomplishments, and I'll just mention that first one. The other ones, just to remind you, and they're in the handouts, were, as well as persistent effort, watchfulness, good friendship, kalyana mitrata, and balanced livelihood. So a little bit of advice, and you can get this sense in the Pali Canon. What happens is the Buddha is encountering people with all sorts of ways of living, and he offers them a choice. He says, well, if you can free yourself from that and become a full-time meditator and a full-time Dharma farer, then that's great. But if that doesn't seem appropriate, you don't feel ready for it, you've got responsibilities, then let me give you some help as to how you can lead an ethical life, a life with space for meditation as well, within your current context. But the challenge is a little bit black and white there. It's not, he doesn't actually talk about transforming the existing social context for them, except by the whole process of going forth. And this seems to me to be the limitation in early Indian Buddhism. In a way, the Buddha responds very well to all sorts of people and gives all sorts of advice in a very free way, you know. But as Buddhism developed, it took all that and it just accepted it. You know, that's the way. Either you're someone who's gone forth, or you try and make the best of the lay life that is sort of landed in your lap. And I think this may reflect conditions in India, where it was actually very inflexible. Social life was very inflexible. You know, you tended to do the trade that your father or your mother did. That is what you did. That's the kind of work you did. You had a particular role. If you're a woman as well, you had a particular role, and that was the role that you followed. And in a way, there wasn't much other option apart from leaving it all together and becoming a homeless wanderer. And there was some respect and encouragement in many parts of Indian history for that, which is, of course, great. But it means that the whole issue of right livelihood as a socially revolutionary possibility was neglected, it seems, in India, as far as we know, in those early days. So the Buddha was saying, oh, this is how you can be ethical in the life that you have been landed with. This is how you can be happy in it and really enjoy it as well. And also, this is how you can prosper in it. You can make it work for yourself. And finally, he very often says, and this is how you can be generous with it. He says, at least you can do that. You can use this form of life to practice dana, to practice generosity in various ways, according to whatever it is. So I want to leave that early Buddhism now and move on to some more general Buddhist teachings from other parts of the Buddhist tradition. I'm actually going to start with one that comes right up to date, and I've already mentioned it. This is a talk that Jack Kornfield gave, an American Buddhist teacher, on right livelihood. And he identified six aspects of right livelihood. Well, he actually identified five aspects, and I'm adding a number six. And I don't know whether he got these somewhere from the tradition or whether he made them up himself. But I think they're quite helpful. So this is Jack Kornfield's five aspects of right livelihood. The first one is non-harming. The second one is appropriate happiness, which you've already got into. The third one is growth and awareness. The fourth is simplicity, and the fifth is service. I won't say much about these, but I will give you some examples of these from other sources. So non-harming, avoiding livelihoods that, for example, involve weapons, exploitation of people, drugs, anything that hurts people, but also helping other people to avoid those as well. So the non-harming, the basic ethical aspect of livelihood that we've already looked at. Then appropriate happiness, the four appropriate happinesses, the happiness in what you've already got, your creativity, your independence, and your clear conscience, your free heart. And then the third one is growth and awareness, which is a very big one. And again, I'm going to go into this a bit. But Jack Kornfield talks about using your livelihood as a context in which to wake up, to start to wake up, practicing mindfulness and realizing that in your work you face reality. This is something that Bhante stresses later on as well. And then simplicity, keeping your work uncomplicated and straightforward, using your work to support a simple life, looking at the temptations of consumerism and maybe resisting those temptations and going for the simple life. And then service, seeing your livelihood in terms of offering benefit to other people, trying to act in a loving and selfless way. So I quite like that list, but I do feel there is something missing from it. I don't know how obvious that is, but just to remind you of what they are again, they were non-harming, appropriate happiness, growth and awareness, simplicity, and service. It seems the whole aspect of livelihood, which, in my opinion, is missing from that. What would you say? Yeah, it was, in other words, the making a living out of it and maybe using it for other... Any other?
Friendship?
Enlightenment? Yeah. We do say growth and awareness, which I suppose you could say, Lisa. So, as well as the thing of actually the business being viable and producing something of value, I'd agree that friendship or the whole aspect of fellowship, I call it fellowship in general because it may be friendship, it may be a little bit more dilute than that, but the whole aspect of fellowship and communication, sangha, if you like, is what is missing there. And I think, again, it's very interesting. It's interesting what is lacking in the early Indian exposition of right livelihood. It's also interesting what's lacking in the American one. And it may be something to do with the conditions of people trying to practice the Dharma in America. It may be there's something in common. I don't really know America well, but there may be something in common between modern America and ancient India in the sense that roles are rather firmly defined in modern America. And it's maybe a little bit difficult to break out of that and to do something a bit more revolutionary. And maybe it is here as well, to be fair. You know, maybe we'll see that. Maybe this is why the early experiments in Right Livelihood, the excitement, to some extent died down. There's a smaller proportion of the people in the After Libya involved in those now. Maybe it's just people are realizing just how difficult it is to create something that is rather new, that isn't really a part of the traditional structure of society. I don't know. So one of the third thing that Jack Kornfield mentions is growth and awareness. And mindfulness is a big aspect of livelihood teachings, particularly in East Asian Buddhism. And I think that what this is bringing out is the fact that your work does have an effect on your state of mind, doesn't it? And it's right, quite a good question to ask yourself, I think, is you go into work at the beginning of the day, you leave work at the end of the day. Are you in a better mental state? Are your mental states better or worse? And sometimes they're going to be worse, aren't they? And sometimes they are actually better. But it's a fair question to ask. And is it a fair thing to ask of your work that actually the way I work or the kind of work I do is going to, if I apply the right kind of effort, is going to leave me in a better mental state at the end of the day? You don't want to be in a worse mental state. I mean, it's terrible, isn't it? You want to be able to be in a situation where you can actually be in a better mental state, usually, at the end of the day. Which doesn't necessarily mean that everything is just really calm and easy. It might be very, very challenging. Better mental state doesn't necessarily mean calmer or something, or more empty-minded. It can mean that you've really learnt something. So there's an opportunity for growth and awareness, one hopes, at work. And this is something which East Asian Buddhism talks about a lot. And in particular, the favourite text here, probably many of you may be familiar with it, is Dogen's advice to the Tenzo. Dogen's advice to the Tenzo being the monastery cook in the Chan, Chinese Chan and Japanese Zen monasteries. And I've given a quote from his advice, the Tenzo. It's a whole book on it, but I've given a quote in the handout, and I'll give you just a small one here to give you a flavour of it. When washing rice, preparing vegetables and so on, do so with your own hands, with close attention, with vigorous exertion and a sincere mind. Don't indulge in a single moment of carelessness or laziness. Don't allow attentiveness to one thing to result in overlooking another. The ancients said that cooks regard rolling up their sleeves as the way-seeking mind. Cooks regard rolling up their sleeves as the way-seeking mind. Treat utensils such as tongs and ladles and all the other implements and ingredients with equal respect. Handle all things with sincerity, picking them up and putting them down with courtesy. So this little extract gives a very vivid impression, I think, of what it's like, not just what it's like to be cooking, but what it's like to be doing any basic work where there's a lot of opportunity for practicing that sense of focus, really being focused and mindful, but also having this respect, this attitude of respect and courtesy towards your fellow workers, towards your tools, towards the ingredients. Really treating it as being important, not thinking, oh, this is just a silly soup I'm making, you know, who cares? But it's actually important. It matters what you're doing, I think. And then there's more that comes out of Dogen's teaching here. For example, when we work attentively, therein lies the principle that makes it possible to surpass our predecessors. Remember, in Zen Buddhism in particular, this is a really crucial thing, that you look at your predecessors and you say, I want my own consciousness to be even more expanded than theirs was, if you like. That you still do not grasp the certainty of this principle is because your thinking scatters like wild horses and your emotions run wild like monkeys in a forest. If you can make those monkeys and those horses just once take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inwards, then naturally you will be completely integrated. This is the means by which we who are ordinarily set into motion by things become able to set things into motion. This is quite a profound teaching, I think, which I'm not going to try and go into detail what it's about, but maybe you can get a sense of it, this sense of the activity of our lives and our mind, like horses, like monkeys, constantly responding to outside stimuli, looking here, looking there, shying away from things, galloping off and so on, then turning the light inwards so that instead of being activated by things, you are yourself setting things in motion. You're now in control of your life. You're integrated. And this you do through your work, according to Dogen. Harmonizing and purifying yourself in this manner, don't lose either the one eye of transcendent wisdom or the two eyes of discriminating consciousness. So you're trying to keep the non-dual wisdom alive, but also the ability to discriminate as well of ordinary consciousness. Lifting a single piece of vegetable, make yourself into a six-foot Buddha and ask that six-foot body to prepare a single piece of vegetable. So this is the attitude you're taking. You're a Buddha picking up the carrot and you're asking that Buddha to prepare that carrot. Please prepare this carrot, Buddha. Those are the cook's spiritual penetrations and magical transformations, his Buddha work and his benefiting of living beings. So I hope that gives you a hint of the way that Dogen approaches work, and it's well worth looking at his teachings on it. And what you can see here is that he's saying it's not just an opportunity for mindfulness and focus, it's not just an opportunity for spiritual growth, but it's also, there's a strong element of vision in there. It's an opportunity for being a Buddha, in other words, for gaining insight, gaining awakening. And Cornfield, as well as talking about growth and awareness through work, he talks about simplicity in work, the value of a simple, contented life. And I think what you can bring in here is the sense of having clear objectives and clear priorities. Sometimes we are so scattered, like those monkeys and horses, and if you think, well, why am I here? What are we trying to achieve here? Does it matter or not? And having that clear objective is a fantastic thing in a job, because you're we'll see later, when you have a team coming together, if you've agreed on this objective, which may just be the objective of we are trying to going to get into profit within 12 months, it might be that, then that objective brings everything together and makes life suddenly rather simple. It doesn't make it easy, but it does make it simple. You know what you're doing, and you know whether you've done it or not as well. And then the last one that he mentioned is service, this element of service, of helping others, which I think is a necessary element. And I think some sense that your work is a service is very important, I think. It may not be that that's the main thing in your work, but at least there's some sense that it's doing some benefit for other people, not just for yourself or not just for your team. But it might be this is the dominant element in your work, and that actually your work is a vocation, is an altruistic profession in itself, like teaching or medicine or whatever. I'll mention that again later. And then the one that I added to the end of Jack Cornfield's list is fellowship, the sense of fellowship. And that leads us into the sense of the team. I'm not going to be talking a lot about team-based right livelihood in terms of our experience in the FWBO and our experience at Windhorse and all that kind of thing. That's really important area to go into. But what I'm hoping is that, in a way, will come out through our shared experience through the weekend, because there's a lot of varied experience available here in this room. So rather than it coming out as a spiel at the beginning, it comes out through us talking about what it's been like for us and what kind of situations we've had and why did we choose that situation and why do we set it up that way. Excuse me. So the sense of setting up teams of Buddhists to work together as a Sangha is not an invention of the FWBO, of course. It's particularly strong in East Asian Buddhism. But if you look at the way it tends to happen in East Asian Buddhism, this is from my very limited knowledge, it tends to be, once again, the monastics that do it. It's the monks and the nuns that decide to get together and to work. Now, they didn't have the same taboo on working that you had amongst the Indian monastic Sangha, who relied entirely on donations of the laity, with some problems. So they were happy to get on with work, but it was still something there for the monastics. And the teaching for the laity would once again be, this is how you can be ethical in your work, without really questioning the way it was happening. So, but we do have some good models there for how do you form Buddhist teams. And maybe this is something that we should bear in mind, that in a sense, as it were, monastic element in a Buddhist team is quite valuable, at least in the sense of we are trying to lead a simple life and we're trying to make our work simple and not stimulating lots and lots of extra needs in us. Because I don't think one needs to see things as black and white, you know, either you're monastic or not. Everyone needs a monastic element in their life. They need some, everyone that is who's practicing the Dharma. They need some retreats, they need some meditation practice and so on. So how can work be integrated fully into a complete Dharma life? If it's going to be a complete life, it must include Sangha. Sangha is essential in Buddhism. So this means your work has to have, it seems to me, a Sangha element, if it's possible. Maybe it's not possible, you know, but if it's possible, it needs a Sangha element, if at all possible. So I'll look at the way that Bhante presents his vision of right livelihood. He develops it, of course, over a long period of time. It's interesting to look at some of his earliest teachings on it, where, for example, he still has this sense that if possible, you should only be working part-time because you should be devoting a lot of time to meditation and study and so on. So you try and set up a team, a right livelihood team, but you see whether you can make the business succeed with everybody working part-time. And this has proved, everyone has tried this, it's proved very, very difficult because to succeed in business needs such a lot of hard work. And this is something that we've encountered often, haven't we? So anyway, let's have a look at what Bhante says a little bit later on, when he reiterates his four main principles of what team-based right livelihood businesses are. First of all, when he's reminiscing about the early days of the movement, this is in the lecture he gave in Berlin in 1992, he says, okay, why does he call them team-based right livelihood? Well, they're team-based because they consisted of a number of Buddhists working together. They worked together along broadly cooperative lines. And they were right livelihood businesses because they operated in accordance with Buddhist ethical principles. So it's just obvious, isn't it? But they're a team and they're ethical. It's not that if you're not in a team, it's not right livelihood. Right livelihood is ethical livelihood. This is quite clear from early Buddhism. But we have this additional element coming in of working together in a team. And then he says, and this one's from the Six Emphases of the After Lubyo. They provide those who work in them with a means of support. That's the first characteristic. They don't pay wages or salaries. They give each worker what he or she needs according to their individual circumstances. So his first thing there was definitely working on a support basis. And it's interesting how that, in some cases, has changed. In some businesses, there is just a basic salary. In the case of Windhorse Evolution, we have an option that some people do work there on wages and some work there on this support system that Bhante is talking about here. They don't pay wages or salaries. They give each worker what he or she needs according to individual circumstances. That is quite revolutionary. I'd be very, very disappointed if we lost that entirely from Windhorse Evolution, because it seems to me to be a real aid to living a Buddhist life, in my experience. Secondly, they engage only in such activities that are ethical, i.e. in accordance with the precepts. And the businesses are run in an ethical manner, and the workers treat one another ethically. So what the business does is ethical. The business is done ethically as well. So you treat your suppliers and so on ethically, and you treat each other ethically. So ethics. Thirdly, they provide opportunities for the development of spiritual friendship within the work situation. And Bhante isn't always consistent in the way he teaches things. So on another occasion, he put this as number two, and he just put it as they enable Buddhists to work with one another. And he emphasizes this is particularly the case where the workers can not only work together, but also live together in a community. And then lastly, the profits of the business are distributed as dana for the benefit of FWBO or TBMSG activities. Or in another source, he says they give financial support to Buddhist and humanitarian activities. So those are the four things that Bhante enumerates. Supporting Buddhists working together in a team. Secondly, ethical. It's an ethical business. Thirdly, it's an opportunity for cooperative and working and developing friendship. And fourthly, it's dana-based. It wants to give away its profits to good causes. And there is something he added in a question and answer session to these. He said, well, if there's anything that's to be added to that, is this business of viability. They've got to be viable. It's got to be something in which all the skills which are necessary for the success of the business are present. So you can't just hope for the best and grab a few people together and found a business. The first one I was part of was Friends Building Service, which was founded after Atta left the team that set up the LBC. So we were trying to do building work without any skills to speak of. And it's very difficult to succeed with something when you don't have the skills. And I can also remember an early business down in Brighton, which was Sunrise Cafe. I hope there's no one here who's going to be offended by this, but it was a macrobiotic cafe in Brighton, and the food was almost completely inedible. I went there out of duty because I felt I should be supporting the Sangha by eating this brown rice and burnt lentils, but that was really what they had. You know, it was very worthy, but I feel the skills were perhaps lacking. So it's interesting to reflect on the changes from Bante's ideals, if you like, there for team-based right livelihood. Has it been watered down? Is it more that it's been extended so it can appeal to more people? Is it that it's been updated because of changing circumstances? And I think it would be just interesting to discuss these things. Maybe it's for commercial reasons, you know, the part-time business I mentioned. Well, you can't do it part-time if you want to be commercially successful, perhaps. So at Wintour's Evolution, we don't necessarily use those particular four criteria. We've now got our own set of, our own ethos, with five aims of the business. The first is dana, is that it's a business set up to give money and so on away. The second is that it's ethical, an ethical business. The third is that it's supporting people's growth, supporting people's individual spiritual growth as much as possible. The fourth is communality. That it's a business where people work together in a communal and cooperative manner. And the last one is that it's making a profit, that it's commercially viable. So there's still, I don't think we've completely lost sight of Bante's original vision. We reformulated it. That's particularly due to Ratnagosha, that reformulation. Now, time is getting on, so I think I'll skip through one or two things. There are some reflections on different kinds of livelihood and how they fit in with team-based right livelihood. Subhuti gave a talk a while ago where he gave a sort of a list of where, at the minimum, you would make sure your livelihood was not unethical. But then you would say, well, can I be in touch with other people working in the same field who are also Buddhists? Or then can I actually work with other Buddhists but in a conventional manner? And then finally, can I work in a team? And I'd add to that this business of vocational working, which I think if you have a strong vocation for teaching or for health or whatever, or even an artistic vocation, it seems to me you have to respect that. You can't just think, what I'd love to do is to be teaching children, bringing them into the world, but yet there's no team-based right living there, so I'd better go and join the cafe. I mean, you know, you may be denying something very important in yourself if you deny that basic vocation. But definitely, it's something that Sangharakshita stresses, the value of right livelihood, the value of team-based right livelihood. He says, it's not difficult to start an FWBO centre. And then he says, it's more difficult than that to start a community, but the most difficult and demanding of all is to start a team-based right livelihood business. But he goes on to say, but it's also perhaps the most worthwhile of all. In some cases, you not only work with other people, you also live with the same people. And working and living with them, you can develop a very close spiritual friendship. You work best on your relationships within the team by all of you more and more devotedly cooperating for the fulfillment of the aims and objectives of the business. So this seems to be the secret of team-based livelihood, is cooperating to fulfill an objective aim, something that you can actually tell whether you're doing it or not. And so, in a way, you have to overcome the differences that arise between you in order to do that. Sometimes you don't, and it doesn't actually work, and it may be a horrible experience. But if you can do it, it means it's very, very growthful indeed. It's a team of same gold people. There's a term in Buddhism called Samanatata. It's one of the four means of unification. And it literally means same goaledness or same idealedness. Samanatata. S-A-M-A-N-A. A-R-T-H. A-T-A-T-A. That's the longest word I've ever spelt out in a talk. Samanatata. It's in the four means of unification, or the four means of conversion, it's sometimes called. So you need people who have that sense of same goaledness are necessary for most teams, I'd say. And what this brings together is Kalyanamitrata, the lovely spiritual intimacy, that literally means, the lovely spiritual intimacy. And this fact of these two things being there, same goaledness and having a spiritual intimacy with each other, is what you need, I think, to turn you round. What we're trying to do in spiritual life is to turn round our consciousness, our awareness, towards reality and away from this very defended and frightened self, which is what we sort of established during our childhood and inevitably have to deal with. How do you do that? You have to do it through a lot of means, but it seems to me these two things coming together, having a strong goal and working together in lovely spiritual intimacy, is going to be much more likely to be effective than other things. Did you want to ask that? But it is very demanding. It's very demanding indeed. And I've got a quote in here about the difficulties of trying to take responsibility together in a cooperating situation and what that leads to, which led to Bhante once saying that he thought that maybe only order members, only people who are fully committed to the Dharma, could really effectively work in right livelihood teams. Having said that, you've had many of the most successful right livelihood teams have actually had no order members in them at all and can't get any order members to join them, you know, much as they may try. So, okay, I'm going to finish off to Sigala, Sigalaka, Foxy, this guy who was doing his strange rituals by the river outside the city of Rajgriha. And you remember that one of the directions he was saluting was the ground. And it happens that the Buddha goes through a different symbolism, a different relationship for each direction. For example, the east, where the sun rises, is your relationship with your parents, because that's where you light the sun, that's where you begin, with your parents. And it mentions friends, it mentions your children, it mentions your teachers, it mentions your spiritual teachers as well. But what's relevant for us today is the ground. And you salute the ground, and the ground is your work relationships. So I'll just give you the quotation. Is this okay? I'm going over time a bit. Is anyone used coping so far with this? I'll try to finish fairly quickly. So the Buddha says to Foxy, "How, young householder, does a noble disciple cover the six quarters?" He goes through the different quarters. And then he says, "In five ways should a master minister to servants and employees as the nadir beneath. Firstly, by assigning them work according to their ability. Secondly, by supplying them with food and wages. Thirdly, by tending them in sickness. Fourthly, by sharing with them any delicacies. Fifthly, by granting them leave at times." The servants and the employees thus ministered to as the nadir by their master show their compassion to him in five ways. It's interesting. Show their compassion to him in five ways. They rise before him. They go to bed after him. They take only what is given. They perform their duties well, and they uphold his good name and fame. Thus, the servants and the employees ministered to as the nadir show their compassion towards him in these five ways. Thus is the nadir, the ground, made covered by him and made safe and secure. So he's sort of bringing the superstition of covering the directions down to earth by saying, how do you cover the ground? You cover it by looking at your working relationships. So right livelihood is a foundation, it seems to me. And I hope that what I've been talking about today is a little bit of a foundation for what we can do this weekend. It's definitely not got the answers in it. I hope it doesn't seem like that anyway. I hope that it's starting things going, that we can look at right livelihood, we can look at perfect livelihood and build on that foundation. So there are a few things I just want to stress as sort of reminders in finishing. First of all, that right livelihood is ethical livelihood. And so it's worth looking at your livelihood carefully in terms of the precepts. Secondly, it's part of the path. It's part of the Eightfold Path, which means it's something you gradually cultivate, that you work on. And then it's possible to enjoy it. It's perfectly okay to look for fun and enjoyment in your working day. There you are, 9 to 5 every day. It shouldn't be a slog, at least not all the time. You can look at it in terms of non-harm and enjoyment, growth and awareness, simplicity, service and fellowship. You can work on your mental states at work, and it is possible to be in good mental states at work. It's possible to cultivate mindfulness. It's also a chance for insight. It's a chance for being a Buddha as you cut the vegetable stems. And this is because the problems that you encounter in work are real and genuine problems. It's very hard to hide from them. Psychological problems you can hide from to some extent, but work problems, you can only escape them by leaving, usually. So there is a chance, therefore, to face reality and gain insight. And working can change lives. It changes not just your life, but lives of the people around you and even lives far away through altruistic work, through vocational work. Through service. And then work teams can be sangha. This is the idea of team-based right livelihood. They can be sangha. Work can offer a positive social setting. And I think it seems to me that we should be proud of the emphasis that the FWBO has given to work and to work as sangha, because it's crucial to today. If people are going to be able to practice the Dharma today, they need to try to bring the Sangha and their work together somehow. And it's very easy to be distracted by all the Eastern forms of Buddhism and their particular stresses and emphases into neglecting, well, if you like, the bankruptcy of our conventional ways in Europe of doing things, and in particular, ways of working. And I think that there are new ways we can do it, and we can discover those new ways by working together in teams of people who are have the same goals and who are prepared for the lovely spiritual intimacy with each other. And then finally, work as a whole has a context. And I want to finish the story of Foxy by this rather surprising turn that happens at the end, because after this very long discourse, the Buddha must be starving, because he's been supposed to be going into town to hope for food. So let's hope there's still a little bit of breakfast left in the houses so the Buddha gets some food. We don't hear about that, but what we do hear about is Foxy himself. He goes home. Remember, his mother is a widow. She's at home. She's got his breakfast ready. The toast is completely like leather. It's almost inedible. He's been out so long. And he says, "Where have you been?" She says, "Where have you been? What have you been doing?" And so Foxy said, "I'm so excited." And he repeats the whole teaching to his mother. And his mother gains insight on the spot, leaves home, becomes a Buddhist teacher, and she reflects on all these teachings in the context of her own work and her own life, and she uses them to gain insight. And in fact, she becomes one of the foremost of the Buddha's female disciples, who is famed for her shraddha, for her confidence. Which is slightly unexpected, because Foxy himself never appears again in the Pali Canon. He entirely vanishes from the scene. We don't really know whether he managed to learn from the Buddha's teachings or not. It was his mum who managed to learn from them. And it is quite interesting that when Bhante was asked about team-based right livelihood, he thought one particular form of team-based right livelihood was a mother bringing up her children. And it could be that this was what Sigler's mother was reflecting on, perhaps, as she listened to secondhand to the Buddha's teachings. So the context is definitely one of vision and of insight, and this is the context that Sigler's mother, Foxy's mother, was able to put it into, and maybe Foxy himself wasn't, but she could see how those teachings weren't just a little bit of advice on how to treat employees and employers and so on, but they were something that could open you out into insight, into understanding reality. Okay, so thanks for your patience. I'll leave it there.